It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat This Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Got you both back this week.
Yeah, I was in Ontario, Canada, reading about Jim West.
They actually carry that in Ontario?
They did.
Oh, yeah, I saw it.
It was a big news story.
I saw it picked up by, I think it was the New York Times picked it up.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it was a big story.
All right.
Hypocrites usually are.
Well, actually, not so much in the U.S. press. Seems like there's plenty of them that we skip over.
Well, it's if they're the mayor of a city, if they're the president of the United States, that's not news.
Yeah, we assume if they've clawed their way to the top that they've already sold their soul. It's not news anymore.
Yeah, but if they're just the mayor of Spokane, it's a shock.
Well, speaking of mayors, let's start out with our own mayor and an initiative he started, Greg Nichols.
Yeah.
It's rare that we run across things that we can salute him for.
Yeah, but speaking of the New York Times, in New York City, Greg Nichols started an initiative for a program earlier this year to get cities across the country to sign up to adhere to the Kyoto Protocol on global climate change. Now, this is a direct challenge to the Bush administration, which, of course, has spurned the Kyoto. And Nichols has been surprisingly successful. He's gotten 132 cities so far to sign up, including bipartisan cities across the country. And this week he added New York City to that. So it's fairly substantial at this point, something like 20 or 30 million people covered by these cities across the country. And in terms of global climate change and actually, you know, making a difference, it isn't that big a difference. It's not as significant as, say, California and its emission standards, that size of a market. But cities can do important things. They can go to hybrid vehicles in their car fleet. They can Seattle City Light has gone to no net emissions. I believe they're the first utility in the country to do that. So there are things that cities can do, and we want to give Nichols some strokes for.
Yeah, I think in addition, cities can also lobby their state legislatures, so you can get, for example, the whole state of New York to follow California's emission standards. If the city of New York were to really get onto the bandwagon, so
yeah, and that is something that they're doing. I understand that they're considering it.
Yeah, so I think that's really, really good news.
All right. Well, earlier on Counterspin, they were talking about CAFTA, and we wanted to brush upon that because
it's in trouble.
Yeah, it's in, which is, we're saying, is a good thing.
Yeah, I don't think anybody here in this studio has ever advocated for multilateral trade agreements. How about you, Jav?
Not recently, no.
No, and I was saying here earlier when we were talking about this off the air that the right wing tends to, or the pro-business folks, tend to take a slap at the left in regards to multilateral trade agreements by saying, well, bilateral trade agreements, that is, agreements between two countries, are not fair because the richer party or the more powerful country of the two will take advantage of the smaller country or the less powerful or less rich country. But I think that that's actually not true. You know, and the left usually doesn't know how to respond to that. I think the correct answer to that is that's not always the case, as we've been seeing with, for example, trade agreements between South American countries and China, and trade agreements between Russia and other countries in Asia and Africa. And we've seen some trade agreements between Japan and South American countries, where some of these countries are getting significant concessions in exchange for their natural resources. So, and I think that they are getting much more out of these, you know, bilateral trade agreements that they're cutting than they would out of a multilateral trade agreement, especially since Europe and the U.S. are not involved. In terms of multilateral trade agreements, like, you know, things that happen through the WTO or things that happen like with CAFTA or other sort of things like that, that what you get is you get the dominant partner, the U.S. or the European Union, getting the bulk of the benefit while the workers in the U.S. and the European Union get screwed, and these small countries also get screwed. So I think it is very, very positive that CAFTA is going down.
Well, and so far, in terms of our Washington State representatives, Brian Baird, Rick Larson, and Adam Smith have all signed on against it. Mm-hmm. But I know Inslee, McDermott, and the two senators haven't spoken out as to which way they're going on that.
Yeah, so definitely folks need to get on the phone and give them a call, or send them some email or write them a letter.
Certainly, Patty Murray, for example, has had a long history of being pro-free trade agreements, and so has Jim McDermott, surprisingly enough. Although he's moderated that stance a little bit in recent years, but they definitely need pressure from listeners. So get on the horn and call them and tell them that the Central America Free Trade Agreement is a bad idea for workers here. It's a bad idea for the Central American countries as well.
Well, moving on to nationally, I'm really actually somewhat surprised how long the John Bolton's process of going through being
anybody know how long ago it was when he was first nominated?
February,
I believe. It's been a while.
Yeah.
It's been a while. And all this time, his nomination as the U.S. representative to the U.N. has been tied up in committee. And it was just this week that the committee finally, on a partisan vote, Republicans for, Democrats against, passed him on to the floor without giving a recommendation that he be approved. Now, this is not entirely unprecedented, but it is very, very unusual. And it really reflects concerns that both Democrats and Republicans have that Bolton is just not the kind of guy you should have in any diplomatic post at all. And I think it's kind of interesting because one of the main stories that came out this week was that Bolton's speeches have been vetted by State Department officials, basically his boss saying, look, you can't even open your mouth unless I've already agreed to what you're going to say. That's how bad some of his comments have been, how inflammatory. This is not the kind of guy who should be a diplomat.
Yeah, and not only inflammatory, but also factually challenged.
Just incorrect.
Yeah, he is in further trouble with the four. Barbara Boxer of California now is threatening to put a hold on his nomination process. So this could drag on for some time to come yet. There's no fixed date set for a floor vote yet. And although Bush is saying that he's four square behind Bolton, yada yada, there may be the five Republicans or six Republicans that are necessary, six actually, because Cheney obviously would vote in favor. Bolton's a Cheney protege. There may be the six Republicans necessary to send Bolton down. We'll see.
Mm-hmm. All right. And also briefly, something else that's been on the radar for quite a while but had a change this week, the filibuster concept with the judge nominations.
Yeah. This is something that the Bush administration has pushed hard on. And it's a topic that's kind of boring for people. They don't really understand this whole filibuster fight.
But and it's going to go to the floor of the Senate this coming week.
Yeah.
So it's going to be big news this week to come.
Yeah. And I'm going to try to explain it in a way that people will understand and make it kind of interesting and make it quick. The filibuster concept is something that goes right to the root of our democratic system is set up. It helps to ensure the rights of the minority party. Now, that's a concept that we should all have learned about in civics class, but many of us didn't even have a civics class when we were in school. But the idea is, if you just have majority rule, then the minority's rights can be easily trampled. And so our system tried to include certain things that would help to ensure minority rights, that a minority group of people or a minority party, their rights would not be, their visions and their views and their thoughts would not be completely done away with and not be completely trampled. The Bush administration has made it a policy to go after the filibuster in the Senate. The filibuster is a way that the minority party can tie up a vote if it really sincerely believes that the vote would do a lot of damage to the country or a lot of damage to the system. And the Bush administration has taken seven judicial nominees that were filibustered by the Democrats and so not approved in the Senate, and George Bush has renominated them again. Instead of doing as what Bill Clinton had to do when 42 of his judicial nominees were filibustered by the Republicans when he was in office, he simply tried to reappoint new people to those positions and get an up or down vote on those. The Bush administration is saying, oh, it's unprecedented, seven of our nominees. That's crap. That's bull. Seven nominees, that's pretty good record. If you get seven filibustered, so what? You appoint new people. The Bush administration has turned around and re-nominated those people and is trying to push them through in an effort to get rid of the whole filibuster concept and therefore get rid of the main tool that the minority party can use to ensure its rights and its views in the Senate. And I find that deeply disturbing.
Yeah, this is something, this is an extension of something that the Bush administration has really been pushing ever since it came into office in 2000, that it has really pushed hard in Congress, and particularly the House of Representatives, where the Republicans have had a solid majority. It has really pushed to exclude the Democrats from rulemaking, from consideration of bills. You know, Democrats often don't see bills until they're actually put on the floor for a vote. Consultation. There's
right.
No consultation at all with the minority party. And this is something that's very, very much a break from tradition and a break from the way that Congress has done business in the past. This is something that the Bush administration has been very aggressive on in the past. This is the escalation of it now by attacking the filibuster rule in the Senate. And it's something people should be upset about.
All right. Also briefly, Tom Ridge came out and said some things this week that he got his hand slapped after he said them.
Yeah.
Often happens when you speak truth to power.
It's true. Tom Ridge, as folks might remember, was the first head of the Homeland Security Department. He's no longer the head of Homeland Security. He resigned after Bush's first term. And he is now talking about what it was like to be the head of Homeland Security. And he said this week that the color-coded terrorism alerts, he said that the threat level would often be raised by members of the Bush administration's Security Council for no apparent reason that he could tell, even after he and other members of his department, and this includes a lot of intelligence analysts, would say that there was no particular threat. The Bush administration's Security Council would often come out and say, well, it's time to raise the threat level anyway. And I think what he was basically saying is, the Bush administration has been using the color-coded terrorism threat level for political reasons, something that we had suspected all along.
Yeah, very, very much to manipulate the fear among American people. And this is done also, remember, in the context of a political election, in the context of an election campaign last year, where the threat level was manipulated under George Bush. And, you know, these color-coded alerts have been an open joke since they were instituted. They really don't mean much of anything to the average citizen, but we've suspected all along that this has been the case, and now it's been confirmed by Tom Ridge.
Yeah, although interestingly, these color-coded alerts mean a lot to you if you're a city that has to put extra police on the streets and
has
to
guard your ports. Yeah, it means a lot to law enforcement agencies.
Yeah, it means a lot to just city coffers and to the public purse, because it costs money to put people out there to search more people to search baggage, more people to search cargo coming into the ports. You know, that's a lot of extra money, and that's something the Bush administration has to answer for.
Yeah, and again, an unfunded mandate from the feds in many cases.
Yeah, they haven't. I know the city of Seattle in particular hasn't gotten much money at all from the federal government for this added security that's necessary when the threat level goes up.
So I understand now to fix that, they're moving to a grayscale alert. That should solve the color coding. Moving along to international, we've been looking at several days now of coverage of riots starting in places like Afghanistan.
Yeah, starting in Afghanistan, but also spreading now. Pakistan, Indonesia, Muslim countries. There was some in Palestine yesterday. All in response to a report in Newsweek magazine about one of the tactics allegedly used by prison guards and interrogators in Guantanamo Bay of flushing a Quran down a toilet as part of the idea of shaming or enraging the people who are being interrogated, who obviously are Muslim. And this is something that is culturally sensitive, as they say. It really has,
to say the least,
really has hit a nerve in Muslim countries, and it really underscores. mean, the whole military response to this has been hilarious. It's like, well, we always try to be culturally sensitive. Well, tell that to the prisoners at Abu Ghraib. I mean, you know, it's absurd. Of course they're not being culturally sensitive. They're intentionally being culturally insensitive. That's part of the interrogation process. And to say otherwise is just, you know, bollocks. I mean,
and it's interesting that they didn't think that when this stuff got out that there would be a problem. You know?
Yeah,
like
just
kind
just
of riots
purely
came out
oblivious.
Of left field. What do you expect? You know,
it's just purely oblivious. Mm-hmm. And this really underscores once again the failings of the war on terror, because you know when you're combating. You're not combating a nation state and its armies. You're combating a particular tactic, and you're combating individuals who choose to join groups. And when you do that, what you're battling for is not it's not territory. It's not something you can militarily conquer. You're battling for hearts and minds, and you have to understand the hearts and minds of people who could be prospectively be considered the enemy. And this is something that the United States has absolutely, completely, totally failed at. The Bush administration in particular has had very, very little interest in trying to understand what motivates not just fundamentalist Islam Muslims, but Muslims in general in the archipelago from Morocco all the way to Indonesia. You know, that whole swath of the world that is heavily Muslim, these are the hearts and minds where we want people not... We want to be isolating the Osama bin Ladens of the world. We want them not to have followers. We want them not to be considered heroes. And in order to do that, we have to be more culturally sensitive to what Muslims think and what they want. And this is something that we have utterly failed at.
And finally, speaking of the war on terror in Uzbekistan, one of our supposed allies in the war on terror, there was also riots this week.
Yeah. The U.S. media has been full of a lot of news stories about George Bush visiting former Soviet republics that are now, you know, their own new independent countries. One place he didn't visit was Uzbekistan. And the reason he didn't go there is because Uzbekistan is known for being one of the most tyrannical regimes in the region. The leader, Islam Karimov, he rules with an iron hand, and he has put in jail a lot of people who have been joining sort of right-wing Muslim groups in order to try to fight and depose his government and set up an Islamic Republic. Now, the problem with that is that there's a lot of grassroots support for some of these Islamic groups that he has persecuted. And there are also a lot of secularists, too, in Uzbekistan who have been trying to fight against the regime, trying to fight for a more democratic system, that he has jailed and said that he has thrown them in prison because they are extremist Muslims and they are not. Now, this week, and this was pretty tragic, I think, something that wasn't covered much, there were a lot of demonstrations, and there was a prison break that was staged in order to break people out of prison who are, should be considered political prisoners and prisoners of conscience, people who were jailed because of their religious beliefs. And there were a lot of demonstrations in the capital city of Uzbekistan. Karimov called out the troops, and just a day or so ago, his troops mowed down with live ammunition, mowed down unarmed demonstrators in the streets of Uzbekistan. This is not something that the Bush administration wants to hold up proudly and say, look, the wave of democracy is sweeping across these former Soviet republics, because here, clearly in Uzbekistan, that's not the case. And in fact, the U.S. government has sent money and aid to the Uzbekistan government. There's a U.S. military base in Uzbekistan, and Karimov gets a lot of U.S. support. That's the reason why we're not hearing about this in the news.
Yeah, and again, the Bush administration talking endlessly about we support democracy around the world, we'll even hold our allies' feet to the fire. You have not heard word one from the White House about trying to support democratic reform in Uzbekistan. Not one word.
Nope.
All right.
And in fact, just one more thing about Uzbekistan. It is one of the stops where the U.S. government has this extradition policy of taking terrorism suspects and sending them back to their country of origin, and sometimes to a country that's not their country of origin, but a place where they will be interrogated with the use of torture techniques. Now, the Bush administration claims that they don't intentionally do that. Ha. In fact, the U.S. State Department has issued a number of reports on torture techniques in Uzbekistan. Uzbekistan has received a number of prisoners from the United States and has interrogated them on our behalf. So that's another thing we need to keep in mind about Uzbekistan. Not only does the U.S. government support a dictator, it also takes advantage of Uzbekistan torture techniques as well.
All right. That takes us then to This Week in Iraq.
This Week in Iraq.
Yes, this week the Iraqi prime minister appointed all but one of the remaining cabinet positions that were empty. The two most important cabinet positions were for the defense minister, who it turns out is a Sunni. However, the new defense minister, a man named al-Dulaimi, is a returning exile. He left Iraq in 1984 and hadn't been back. That's correct. He had not been back into the country for 20 years. He's now the new defense minister, obviously someone who doesn't have a whole lot of support from local Sunnis. The oil minister, who the oil ministry had been overseen very, very briefly by Ahmed Chalabi. The new oil minister is a Shiite man named Ibrahim Bar al-Alum. He was the oil minister who was handpicked by Paul Bremer, by the U.S. viceroy, way back just after the invasion. So that's the first, I suppose you would call it the interim government. He was the first oil minister. Al-Alum was very controversial because he has very, very limited experience in the oil industry, no practical hands-on experience. He had mostly worked for a few oil consulting firms in Britain. He was also a very, very strong believer in the privatization of Iraqi assets. So one of his first things when he got into office was to make this big announcement to Western oil companies, look at all these wonderful assets we have. Why don't you come in here and buy them up and develop them? He wasn't able to go forward with this program because he was not part of an elected government, and so he didn't have the legal standing to do that. And Paul Bremer, because of major protests that occurred when that was announced, had to actually go back on the privatization program. The Bush administration had to pull back on the whole privatization of Iraqi assets program. That's probably going to go forward now if the security situation improves at all in Iraq. Now, there's another development as far as the new government is concerned. The assembly appointed a council to draft the Constitution. This is going to be the most important document, probably one of the most important things to come out of the new government if the new government survives. On this council is heavily dominated by Shiites. There's also a large number of Kurds. On this council, there's only one Sunni member, only one out of 55 members. And that tells you something about the lack of representation of a major minority party. And we can see what it happens when there is the lack of representation of the major minority party. This week, the insurgency ramped up yet again. The insurgency, which is mostly Sunni-dominated, so much so that the U.S. military analysts are assuming that the attacks are being aimed at the new government and that the new government could be in peril from the insurgency. And this is borne out when we look at the statistics. There were 67 suicide bombings in the month of April alone, and that's a record high. That's out of a total of 135 car bombings for the month, and that's more than double the number that happened in March. Insurgent attacks have gone from 30 to 40 in the months of February and March, up to 70 per day in April and in the first part of May. So they've approximately doubled the number of daily attacks. A number of these attacks are occurring inside the capital city of Baghdad, so it's no longer a process of simply trying to cut off Baghdad by having a lot of these attacks going on in towns on the periphery. They're actually doing a lot of these attacks inside the city of Baghdad. On Thursday alone, if we just look at one day this week, there were 5 suicide bombings. That's not the total number of bombings. There were also a lot of roadside bombs, a lot of car bombings in general, just cars parked that exploded, etc. But there were 5 suicide bombings, with the 2 worst ones in the towns of Hawija and Tikrit, and 3 others happened in the capital city of Baghdad. In Hawija, 30 Iraqi army recruits were killed and 35 were wounded. In Tikrit, 33 people were killed and 80 were wounded, most of them civilians, in a market next to a police station. So this is what is going on that we're not hearing about in Iraq. And if we do hear about it, it's you know, just a little mention here and there. It's not ever put together where you can really digest it. Roadside bombs are still a major problem, and insurgents are even beginning to shell U.S. Army checkpoints. 3 U.S. Army troops were killed this week in one such attack. And so we have the U.S. response, which this week came in the form of Operation Matador. That's the first major U.S. offensive since the destruction of the city of Fallujah.
That's a lot of bull.
Yeah, Operation Matador. 1,000 U.S. Marines, approximately 1,000 U.S. Marines, attacked the town of Qaim and outlying villages in the far west of Anbar province. That's right near the Syrian border. Now, Qaim is on the road from Baghdad to Syria. If you look at a map, you'll see Baghdad, you'll see the capital city of Baghdad, and then you'll see Fallujah. You see a little road that runs by Fallujah, and then it goes through Ramadi, which is the capital city of Anbar province, and then it goes through Haditha. Finally, it goes through Qaim before it reaches the Syrian border. Now, U.S. troops encountered very fierce fighting on the ground, which they did not expect, and so they called in helicopters and jets to bomb the crap out of the place. And so what we're getting is reports of houses being destroyed without a good idea of how many people were inside, how many were civilians, if there was one gunman, if there were 50. We don't know. And so we get these ridiculous reports from the U.S. military that we've killed at least 100 insurgents, a nice round number, when the reporters embedded with troops don't even really claim that. They say, well, the U.S. military claims it has killed 100 insurgents, but there is no body count. And it's impossible to tell, and I didn't personally see them kill 100 insurgents. In addition, residents have fled the town of Qaim and the surrounding villages. They're now camped in tents along the highway. This is a desert area, by the way. Many of these people fled 3 to 5 days ago when the fighting first started. They did not have time to take a lot of food and water with them. Some of them are camped without tents. There are sandstorms this time of year, and it is generally very, very miserable for the residents of this region. In addition, the main hospital, the only hospital in the region, the very small hospital in Qaim, has been damaged, and doctors are trying to treat people from private homes. It is very, very bad and desperate situation. Something that is always true when you have a military offensive in a civilian area, and it's something that we're not getting a good picture of because there are very few reporters on the ground, as opposed to when the U.S. attacked Fallujah and there were a lot more reporters around. So I want to just go on and say that as far as the fighting is concerned, they've noticed that the insurgents have a lot of weapons that they didn't expect, like night vision goggles and armor-piercing bullets, and are generally very well trained. The U.S. says that's because they're foreign fighters. However, local residents say, no, these are local people just trying to defend their house. They're trying to defend their homes and their home territory. If we remember that most of the military under Saddam Hussein was composed of Sunnis, we can see this as these are former military guys trying to defend their turf. In addition, I want to say that it does appear that there are some foreign fighters coming into Iraq. I would say definitely some people from Syria, especially when you attack a border region, you're going to get some Syrian nationals in there as well. There are some other things coming across the border as well. The UN International Narcotics Control Board warned this week that Iraq is becoming a major transshipment point for drugs. Drug traffickers are finding it easy to bring drugs across from Afghanistan through Iraq to Jordan, which is the major exit point from the Middle East to Europe and to Asia for drugs, particularly heroin. That's something that war has brought to Iraq that nobody expected. the drug trade. That wraps up This Week in Iraq.
And with that, out of time. Talking once again with John Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, co-editors of Eat the State. And very quickly, where can people find Eat the State?
Eat the State comes out every couple weeks, local as well as national and global news and events. It's free of charge, where you find free publications, bookstores, cafes, etc. You can also find it on the web, www.eatthestate.org.